Welcome to First Contact Stories of the Call Center. I'm your host, Christian Montez, where we dive into the lives that connect us all, one call at a time, revealing the stories behind the leaders' transformative journeys in the contact center world. All right. Hey, everyone, and welcome to this month's episode of First Contact. Today, we have Jay Baer, a visionary whose path through politics, digital marketing, customer experience has made him a foundational figure in really redefining the customer journey. Now, look, he's had a multifaceted career. He's really actually been a leader in a lot of areas, but he's really been able to create five multi-million dollar companies. He's the author of 7 books, and one of them, which actually is an amazing read, The Time to Win. If you haven't read it, if you haven't bought it, you should. It's a great read. It's a short read, and we'll talk about it later, which highlights the crucial role of speed in customer experience. And he's also developed strategies for over 700 brands. Jay, welcome to the show. Excited to have you here.
Christian, thanks so much. Great to be here. Thanks for having me on.
Yeah. And you know, one of the things that we do at the show is really talk about your origin story, right? What is it that got you from where you were in the early days of your career until where you are now? And we always find that it's not always what you expected. Some people say that's what I always want to do for my whole life. Can you give us some of that journey? How did you get to where you are today?
Yeah, I mean, I started, as was mentioned, I started in politics. I was a political consulting major in school and worked in political campaigns. And then I realized pretty quickly, like, I loved it, but it's not a great gig. Like, it's kind of a hard job, and people either love you or hate you. And I just decided that maybe I didn't want to do that anymore. And then I got a job working for the Department of Corrections as a spokesperson. So I was, I think, 23 years old and was actually the spokesperson for the Department of Corrections. And I realized very quickly that government service was not really my preferred path. It just didn't have that kind of entrepreneurial spirit that has been in my family forever. I'm a 7th generation entrepreneur. We've been self-employed since like 1842 or whatever. So working for the government, I was like, nah, this is not going to work for me. And I was like, I will do anything to not do this anymore. And some friends of mine from school had started the very first internet company in Arizona, like literally the first company. This is in 1993, Christian. And it was so long ago that domain names were still free because, you know, why would you want to have a website? We'll just give you a domain name. And so they're like, hey, this internet company is getting kind of big and we need to know more about marketing and communications. And I said, well, that's fine. Because when you say the word internet, I don't really know what that means. Because I think at that point I'd only ever been on AOL, you know, so we're talking a ways back. But I'm like, look, I'll do anything to not give another prison tour. So I quit my job working for the government, started this internet company. And it was so long ago that we actually sold Budweiser.com, the domain name, to Anheuser-Busch for 50 cases of beer.
Nice.
That's a true story. So I really, really loved and still do digital. And I was so fortunate to be involved in it, you know, before there was even a browser, like way, way, way back. And the measurability of it, the finality of it, the track and traceability of it was really appealing to me. I'd had some experience in television and radio and print and direct mail and a lot of other forms of marketing and communications. And especially in those days, it's like, is this working? You'd be like, I think it's kind of working. Like, you just didn't have a lot of proof points. And so the digital side of it, I really loved, like, oh, there's math. Like, I can tell whether this works or not. And I really enjoyed that. And so over time, I just built my career in digital marketing and then ultimately more and more got involved in customer experience as customer experience and digital became the same thing.
Mm-hmm. So as that entrepreneur mindset, right, and you're saying 7th generation and it's funny how you said the date on that. It's like, that could be a t-shirt, right? You know, been self-employed, yeah, or, you know, a founder since X. But when you think about that mindset, right, of having a business and running a business, what made you sit there and say, I have to have my own business, or I have to be able to run a business or build a business? Because there's a lot of people that sit there and say, oh, I want to be my own boss, but that doesn't always work. And for some people, they hit a ceiling where they just can't get past certain level. What made you say, I got to do this? And I get it, you have the background and the family, but what was your driver during that?
Yeah, like I always thought I could do it. Like I had a lot of leadership positions in high school and college and those kind of things. And so I never really had that, like, there's no way I could do that. Especially as you said, my family had been doing it for generations. So there was never really like that, oh, I'm not capable of it. I didn't ever have that problem. But I was scared to do it because the downside freaked me out. So I was very fortunate because I got involved in digital and some other things early. I had a series of pretty good positions after that. So I was actually making pretty good money relatively young. And I was running some internet companies and stuff. And I kept thinking, man, I really should start my own thing. Like that's where it's at. But I was scared. I didn't, like, what if it doesn't work out? And I had a young child at the time and married. And I was like, it's just too risky, I guess, was my objection, right? Not a competency issue, but a risk issue. And I'll tell you a story. And this is, I think about this every week still. When I was 30, my best friend, who had been my best friend since we were 7 years old, he was such a good friend that he actually married my wife's sister. So my best friend became my brother-in-law, which I totally recommend if you can do that. It makes like Thanksgiving so much more fun, right? And so we spent all of our time together, the four of us, and it was just amazing. But when we were 30, he called me one day and said, hey, I just got back from the doctor. I'm like, hey, what's up? He's like, turns out I have brain cancer.
Wow.
And I went in the next day and I quit because I realized, like, what am I actually scared of here? Like, okay, I start a company and it doesn't work out. Like, I could go get a job. I could definitely go get another job. Right. And I was like, that was the push I needed to sort of contextualize my own fear and realize, like, it's not that big of a deal. And so I went in and quit and I haven't worked for anybody since. And we unfortunately lost my buddy Al not too long after that, but that was the day, and haven't ever gone back.
Wow, that's such an emotional journey, right? To have a catalyst like that puts things into perspective, right? And the concept of time and what fear really drives or limits us. And fear is just such a beast of a thing, right? It's that thing that within our own heads, it can consume and it can also keep us from doing amazing things. At the same time, it also keeps us alive. We know we're alive when we have a sense of pain or fear, we understand things. So it's a great teacher. So, you know, when we think about this dynamic of your past, right, we talk about the government side, the environmental side, and then you go into digital, and then you're now really trying to meet that world of that customer journey, that customer experience, and the ability to measure things, right? And you're sitting there going, well, I can measure this stuff. I can see what's working and not working. I can layer tactics. What did you learn, if anything, from the government side, the environmental services side, all these pieces that comes back into your modern side and say, okay, there's actually things I can take away? Or was it really just silos of your life that they really don't have overlap or value to one another?
No, I think the lesson is this, and I've been so fortunate even up till now, is that, yes, I worked in government. I worked for waste management and environmental services. I worked in a political campaign office. I started as the direct mail specialist for John McCain. That was where I started my career. I did all the direct mail for John McCain. And I worked in TV, you know, on air. I just had a lot of different pieces and parts. My partners and I, unfortunately, sorry, we didn't know. We actually sent the first spam email in the history of the internet. We didn't know what was going to happen. So, I mean, you could trace it back to me, actually, but I'm sorry. We didn't know. But the lesson I've drawn from all those things is that, yes, there are differences in company type, category, organizational type, et cetera. But ultimately, what customers want and how you should treat them is the same. We make way too big of a difference out of company type and category and B2B versus B2C. And usually that's just people who don't want to do the work. The reality is all marketing and customer experience is rooted in human emotion. And those emotions are the same regardless of company or category. That's one of the things I've learned.
You know, it's interesting you state that because, you know, we're starting to get to an age where the customer expects things to happen in a certain way. You have all my data. You should know me already. This feeling of one to many becomes more one to one. This of
Just connect, wait.
Right. Connect with me where, when, and how I want to be connected with. And so when we talk about business and we talk about the journey that customers go through, regardless of the brand or product or service, is there anything that used to be the norm and it was acceptable? It was a traditional way of doing business. And then just today, it's like, you just can't get away with that anymore. And if you don't, you're going to get left behind. You know, are there things that we're doing now or should be doing now that we look at it from, you know, we focus a lot in the contact center, customer journey, customer experience side of it. And we're starting to see adoption of a lot of technologies. But is there anything that you've seen over time that you sit there and go, these are things that we should not really?
Yeah. One of the things, and I talk about this on stage all the time because I you know, 48 weeks a year, I'm on the road giving speeches. And one of the things I talk about a lot is sort of where we're at with regards to empathy. So I'm old enough to remember, and I think you are too, that treating customers with kindness and dignity and respect was just the default setting. Like, we didn't ever have conversations. Like, there's all these books now about empathy in business, et cetera. There was no books about empathy in business when I was in my 20s or 30s because those books didn't need to be written. You know, as I said, my family's been self-employed forever. The number of conversations I had with my dad or my grandfather about having to treat customers with kindness and dignity and respect, zero conversations ever, because it was just axiomatic. Like, of course, that's how you treat people. But somewhere along the way, I think we kind of lost our way, and we find ourselves where we are here, which is in an era of empathy deficit. It's no longer the default setting to treat one another with kindness and dignity and respect and sort of go the extra mile emotionally for customers. And that's true in business. It's certainly true in politics. It's even true in our day-to-day interactions at the grocery store or the airport or whatever. And that makes me kind of sad, actually, as a human being. But I'll tell you, as a business strategist, it's a massive opportunity, because when customers expect so little, all you got to do is give them a little kindness. And they're like, holy mackerel, I was talking to this call center and I wasn't treated like shit. Amazing, right? Like it's crazy. Like, you just got to give them a breadcrumb of kindness now. And it stands out against, like, they expect to be treated poorly. And there's tons of data that indicate that. And so if you just add a little bit of emotional resonance, it really does make a difference. I mean, look at Chewy. I mean, Chewy.com is a perfect example. I mean, they're a very large pet supply company, growing like crazy. And some of its product selection and some of its price, and that's fine. But what really drives their success is their empathy. You may know this tale, Christian, where if somebody loses a pet, Chewy's team will find a picture of that pet, and they paint an oil painting of the pet, FedEx it to the owner's home, and it just creates this incredible empathy bond, which then obviously spurs a lot of social media, but builds those customer relationships for life. I read an article just last week. They have over 1,000 contract oil painters working for them now.
Yeah, that's incredible to be able to think about that. There's this one thing that they do that's so different versus just better. I don't just have the best product or the best price,
yeah, or the cheapest, yep.
You know, whatever thing is they found something different that they could do that connects emotionally to people. And I mean, look, for any of us who are owners of pets, which I am, I just dread the day that I have to think about, you know, what happens when I lose, you know, one of our family members like that. And you sit back and have to go, well, gosh, you know, I didn't ask. I didn't send them an email saying, hey, you know, I want to, you know, get this oil painting done. It's the fact that they're proactively doing that.
Yeah, they're not commissioning oil paintings. Yeah, it's different. Yeah,
exactly. Yeah. It's not like, oh, we got this 1,100 people here now. What do we do? Hey, we should start selling paintings now.
Right. You know, yeah, like they're an Etsy store. Yeah, it's not like
exactly
that.
I think that kind of takes it to another level. But, you know, when we talk about the strategies, and you gave a great one right now with Chewy as an example, some they've done that was different and they embodied empathy. Is there anything else outside of empathy? When we talk about, you talked about that journey with call centers, right? And you're dreading that moment of like, oh, this is going to suck, right? This is not something I'm going to enjoy. It's going to be a painful experience. And you said that bar has been set low. Anything else that, you know, in that space they can take on?
I'll tell you one thing that's actually different now than it used to be. And now it just seems commonplace, but I think it merits pointing out. Call centers are now today do a much better job of closing the uncertainty gap, which is one of the key principles in my new book. This idea that customers hate to wait, and I'm sure we'll talk about that, but the thing they hate second most is an information asymmetry. So when the business has more information than the customer, that creates a lot of anxiety. And it didn't used to matter. Like again, back in the day, we were okay with not having information because we didn't have the internet in our pocket all the time. So my wife and I were watching TV the other night and Cher came on. And my wife says, "How old is Cher?" And I'm like, "I don't know, pretty old." So I just asked Siri, and Siri said that Cher was 78. And I'm like, man, props to Cher and her plastic surgeon. But then I thought, okay, in days gone by, what would it have required to determine how old Cher was? And I was like, okay, in the pre-internet times, you would have to get in your car and go to a library, right? And ask a librarian who might have a book on actors and their birthdays, right? And so it would have taken like legit low-key, like, I don't know, 2 hours to answer that question. And of course, nobody would do that. And so in those days, what we would say was, it was an amazing phrase. You almost never hear it now. "I don't know." You would just say, "I don't know." It is apparently unknowable how old Cher is. And people were totally okay with that. Like, "I don't know" was an acceptable response to almost any query. And of course, today it's not acceptable because you can get that information. You can just talk into your phone or any number of other interfaces to access it. And that idea of omnipresent information really makes a huge difference in call centers and with customer experience. Because when people don't know what's on the other side, it freaks them out now because they're just not used to it. So where I'm getting at is, it wasn't that long ago that when you would be on phone hold, for example, in a call center, you would just hear the initial recording, which is, "Hey, calls are answered in the order in which they are received." And to me, this is an aside, but that's like the funniest thing I've ever heard, because I always ask myself the same question. What was the second choice for the sequence in which calls would be answered? Instead of in the order they are received, we're going to answer calls by height and weight. Like, what was the backup idea? By you know, lifetime value? I don't know. It always makes me laugh. But now, of course, when you call, they always tell you, you know, expect 11 minutes or whatever, that, you know, they give you a time quote as to when they think you're going to answer your call. And that little change in call center behavior is massively important in terms of closing the uncertainty gap around what is this interaction going to require. Or now, of course, we've taken the next step, which is we'll call you back, et cetera. There's a lot of other technologies. But just the very fact that it wasn't that long ago, if you're on hold, you would have no idea. It might be 2 minutes. It might be 2 hours. We won't tell you how long it's going to be. And so you had to be like, "I guess I'll clear my schedule." And that created a ton of anxiety. And so over time, I think call centers are doing a better job of keeping customers informed as to what that exact interaction might feel like, which brings the anxiety down and I think yields better outcomes.
Yeah, I think you're spot on with that anxiety level of the unknown, right? And obviously outside of the contact center space, that applies in everything, right? The unknown is sometimes scary, but the other side of it is you don't know how much time it's going to consume. And some of us, you know, take a whole day off because we got to figure out.
I got to call the cable company, so can't go in.
Yeah, it's like, you know, you sit there and you're like, "I got to go to the DMV. I better take the next day off," right? You know, you're going to have to be in line forever and get stuff done. Yeah. When you think of that anxiety, I can totally see what you're saying when you talk about the idea that it's like, hey, you're this much time left, or you're the 11 people are ahead of you, or, you know, there's iterations of trying to give you a sense of time. And then obviously you alluded to future tech that people adopt all the time now, which is like a queue callback, you know, "Hey, we'll call you back. If you don't want to wait in line, we'll save your spot," kind of thing, and so on and so forth. So as we kind of shift to all the brands that you've advised, right? I think there's like 700 plus of them. Is there anything around that journey when you've seen the advising of these brands, when you're talking about how they market, how they grow, how they help their business see what their customer wants? Has there been an evolution that you've seen over time especially of how they've adopted tech? Or has this been kind of like what you said earlier, you know, it's empathy, it's emotion, it's the same thing? Or have you seen an evolution of how these companies or how you've told these companies what they should do best or how they should improve?
Yeah, I think there has been a change. It's not a linear line, and it to some degree, I think, is driven more by company leadership than it is by macro trends. But I have seen a change even in the last 3 years in companies viewing customer service and customer experience as a revenue driver or a potential revenue driver, even if it's churn reduction as revenue driver, seeing it as a potential revenue driver instead of as a cost. Because for almost the totality of my career, almost all executives view service and experience as a cost, as something that they have to pay for this. And the reality is, and of course, this has been documented a million times in my own books and in a lot of other sources, if you get it right, like, customer experience is your best marketing. And I think everybody understands that, like, anecdotally, like, most people don't argue the point, but yet they don't actually run their businesses as if it were true. And so when you have kind of a sideways economy, like we've had in some sectors coming out of the pandemic, et cetera, in many cases, the first thing to go is customer service and customer experience, which to me is a very short-sighted way of thinking. But you know, a lot of executives, you know, have to think short period because of the nature of public markets and things like that. But even in the last couple of years, as I said, I've seen more and more companies realize, like, you know what, if we get this right, not only will it reduce churn, which makes us money, but it can also be a competitive differentiator. Chewy, again, is a great example, right? Like, does Chewy have better pet supplies than PetSmart or whoever? No. Do they have better pricing? No. But everybody wants to work with Chewy because they are the best at empathy and customer care. And ultimately, if you can do it right, it can be your competitive advantage. And in a world where it's very hard, harder than ever, to actually sustain a product or price advantage, to me, if you can't win on experience, like, what's the point? But of course, I've been talking about this for a long time. So of course, I would say that, but I'm starting to see more companies truly understand that being the best at service can be the thing that separates them.
Running a contact center these days takes a great deal of courage and fortitude. Nobel Biz would like to salute the contact center community for not giving up and working hard to drive their businesses down the road to success. As the promise keepers of the industry, our goal was to provide one of the most versatile and cost-efficient omnichannel solutions on the market. Nobel Biz OmniPlus is a cloud contact center software that gives instant access to a full range selection of channels, from voice calls, two-way SMS, email, WhatsApp, Twitter, Telegram, among others. Our solution offers complete control over the externalities by switching from an on-premise technology to a cloud-based solution in just a matter of hours. Get integrated compliance support, advanced reporting, seamless agent and supervisor dashboards, and many more performance-enhancing capabilities, all in just one product. Nobel Biz OmniPlus, the future-proof solution for scaling contact center operations. Learn more about Nobel Biz OmniPlus at www.nobelbiz.com.
Yeah, I think it's really interesting, that piece where you're talking about the experience that you give people being your differentiator, and that the customer experience side is just this cost. And I've seen the same thing where it's a cost center, right? This part of my business is just a cost. And when it's treated like that, empathy is nowhere near that bubble, right? That bubble is...
Yeah, because empathy takes time.
Yeah. Well, not only that, but I mean, it takes effort, takes money. For people to sit there and go, this is what I want, you know? And when people can say, well, I want to spend that elsewhere, they're just looking at it as like this thing that's passive. And, you know, people aren't like that. People buy many times from people they want to buy from, or that nowadays there's people that have a cause or an experience that they say, hey, this is memorable for me. Let's kind of shift a little bit to something you said on a podcast recently. You said, when you lose because of speed, it is almost always invisible. I loved it. I'm not going to kind of go through what you meant because I want to hear from you. What did you mean by that? And how are companies really missing the mark by having this happen?
Yeah, I'll give an example. Well, first of all, and the reason I wrote the new book, The Time to Win, is that we care about our time more than ever. It's partially a pandemic thing. Like, we realize that nothing's guaranteed, and all these trends in business, you know, quiet quitting, great resignation, working from home, Major League Baseball pitch clock, like all of those things are the same trend, which is that we care about time more than ever. And companies need to elevate speed and responsiveness on their list of priorities, because for their customers, it's already been elevated, right? We, in the research that I did for the book, we found that 2/3 of Americans say that speed is as important as price. That's a pretty significant finding. Now, when you're in a competitive situation and you don't win because you're not the fastest, there is little evidence of that for you. So my friend Kelly runs a little advertising agency here in Bloomington, Indiana, and she was working with a client who wanted to do an outdoor advertising campaign, about a $40,000 budget, so a decent little budget for billboards. So she called the three kind of main billboard companies in our region to put together a spot buy for $40,000 worth of boards. So the first billboard company got back to her same day and said, hey, here's kind of what we're thinking. Second billboard company took a couple days to get back to her. Third one took like a week to get back to her. And at that point, she'd already placed the buy with the first one. They actually weren't the least expensive. In fact, they were the most expensive. But she didn't care, because a lot of this, again, is psychology. We live in an era now where we interpret responsiveness as respect. If you hear back from somebody quicker, the way you internalize that is, oh, they care about me. They care about my business. They care about my well-being. They're going to be easier to work with, like all the important signals, as opposed to somebody who can't even return your message for a week. You're like, huh, what's up with that? That's probably not a good experience. So Billboard Company 2 and Billboard Company 3, who did not get the order, they think they lost on price. Like, we always think it's price. It's human nature. Anytime we lose a competitive scenario, we always think it's price. Again, I've been doing this for 30 years, and it's almost never price. It's almost never price. It's almost always experience, in this case, speed. And so what you do is, the next time there's a billboard job, you drop your price, and you still don't get it because you're not any faster. You're just cheaper. And then you do it again and again, and you take all your profit margin and you throw it away. And it ultimately, there's no spreadsheet or report that you can run that says, show me all the clients we didn't get because we're too slow. There's just no data on it. And so you can really go down the wrong path experientially, thinking that your issue is that you're not, that you're at a price disadvantage, when in fact, you're just at a responsiveness disadvantage.
Yeah, it's interesting how time nowadays, so it feels different when it comes to, like you said earlier, the consumption of information. I make this joke of how, you know, you go back 100 years and people are like, what? You can make a phone call. You can see something on the television. It's like, I'm so amazed. You had this idea of adoption of buying something on the internet and putting your credit card in there. It's like, I don't know if I trust this. And nowadays, you know, we're all pissed off that we're not the Jetsons and we're flying around and we haven't cured cancer. We're just upset that things don't happen as fast as we want. So when I was reading your book, and for those of you who haven't, right, I said it earlier, you know, it's really a neat book because of how thin and small it is. And I get that you wanted speed to be important. So within, you know, a little over an hour, you have this thing read. And so I'm sitting there going like, yeah, you put some thought into the size and the length of this book straight to the
point. I started writing it. And, you know, I've written 6 other kind of what you consider to be full length business books. And I started working on this one and I was like, wait a minute, man. You can't ask people to invest 6 hours reading a business book about speed. Like, that's not just like, it's the exact opposite of the advice that you're trying to contain in this book. So I'm like, all right, let's just like live the thesis here and let's write a very short, very concise, you know, all meat, no fat business book. And people love it. It's been really successful because, people don't read business books. They skim them. So I'm like, all right, I'm just going to give you a short one and cut out the middleman.
Yeah, no, it's really good to see that when we read, you're right. A lot of times we're skimming through things. Sometimes we don't have the time to really have that continuous focus. And a lot of times that we may do it, and there's these ideas that you have to stop, reread it, or you have to go back and then you have to write something down. And some of these things, when it's easily digestible, right? And you kind of don't have to get to the fluff. You don't have to get to the fillers or the 13 examples. You can get to like one really good example. It allows you to really go back and say, I get it. I understand where that
I mean, passed. Look, true story. Business books today, even today, are supposed to be at least 244 pages. Okay. And some of those can be illustrations. Some of them can be acknowledgments. Some of them can be whatever, but 244 pages in length. Why does that make for better learning? No. It's because 244 pages creates a sufficient spine width to rack those books in physical bookstores. So literally business authors are required by major publishers to write 244 pages. So the millions of people that are buying business books in physical bookstores, which doesn't really happen that much other than airport bookstores, can actually see the spine. That's how like perverted the publishing industry is now. And I know this because for my previous six books before this one, I worked with Penguin, right? The biggest publishing company in the world. And I was like, look, I'm just not doing this anymore. It's absurd.
It's interesting how things that made sense in the past now, right, aren't relevant. Like, yeah, I need to have, you know, a physical copy of this. Yeah, that makes sense. If I want it shipped to you, you know, is the weight of it, the size of it, the cost to ship it. But the idea that it has to be able to stand upright inside of a shelf so that I can display these things, I can read, you know, maybe the title on the side of the book easily. You're right. Most people don't consume their books by physically going in somewhere. Now, don't get me wrong. There's definitely people that still do. But I don't remember the last time I bought a book in store. I usually buy it online, or you have audiobooks as well for those of us that
audiobooks listen. Huge for business books. Audiobook listenership has really, really grown in the business category even since I started writing business books, whatever that's been, 12, 15 years ago. Because people are like, look, I can do it in the commute, I can do it on the treadmill, I can do it, you know, whatever, on the bike. It's just a more efficient use of time.
Yeah, no, definitely. And you know, let's kind of go back to this idea of examples that are really good about describing these experiences, right? And recently you talked about one with Delta Airlines. It really was highlighting an unusual set of empathy. Can you kind of discuss how this level of empathy can create word of mouth and enhance that customer experience?
Yeah, I mean, what creates word of mouth? My previous book was all about that. It's called Talk Triggers, and it's all about sort of strategic word of mouth. The thing about word of mouth, what people talk about is something different, not something high quality. One of the big mistakes that businesses make with regards to word of mouth is they assume that competency creates conversation, and it doesn't. Competency keeps your customers, right? Competency reduces churn, but you don't say, hey, Christian, let me tell you about this experience I had last night. It was perfectly adequate. Like, nobody ever says that, right? Because it's not a good story to tell, and it's not a good story to hear. And because it's not a good story, you're not going to repeat it. Because what is word of mouth? It's just a story. What's a review? A review is word of mouth with shelf life, right? So every review also has a story, typically, which is why you don't see a lot of 3-star reviews, because there's no story. Like, hey, I paid them and I got pretty much what I thought. 3 stars. Like, people don't spend time doing that. Reviews are typically 5 stars. This is amazing. I can't believe it. Or 1 star. Stay away, right? There's a story inside the review because it's word of mouth. So you notice things that are different, and you just sort of ignore things, even if they're high quality, that you expect. And so I was going to Australia a couple of years ago to do some speaking for Volkswagen of Australia. And my wife got to go with me that time, which is cool. And we were connecting on the flight from LAX to Brisbane, which is a long day. And we're going through the gate there, and the gate agent scans my boarding pass. Boop, and looks in that little black box they have there by the gate. I don't exactly know what's in that box, but obviously it has your name and your seat number, that I know, but it must also give them your status with the airlines, because boop, oh, Mr. Bear, thank you very much for your loyalty to us here at Delta. We appreciate your Diamond Medallion status. Hope you have a nice flight. And that was, you know, that was nice to hear, but I fly so much. Like, I've heard that story a lot, right? So it didn't really, I wasn't shook by it or anything. But then she scans my wife's boarding pass, boop, looks in the little black box, and I presume realizes that my wife does not have very many frequent flyer miles, because she says, oh, Mrs. Bear. Mrs. Bear, I'd like to thank you for what you must be doing at home to allow your husband to spend so much time with us here at Delta. So, ma'am, in particular, I hope you have a spectacular flight.
Never happens.
Never. And we went down that, we legit went down that jetway in tears, because not only did she like completely nail our relationship dynamic and how important my wife is to the work that I get to do, but we'd never heard anything like that, right? That kind of acknowledgement and awareness and just sort of situational empathy. What I love about that story is that's not a script, right? That's not a training exercise inside Delta. That's a person treating a person like a person. And to me, that's the root of true empathy. And those are the things that stand out. And so then you talk about sort of the downstream impact of that, right? I've told that story, you know, probably 100 times on stage to audiences between 400 and 2000 business leaders, plus in a book, plus in a few podcasts. Like a lot of people have heard this story because I keep telling that story. And what's the ROI on that? I don't know, but it's definitely positive.
Yeah, I can't imagine that hurting anybody. And I think the other piece of it though, right? The consistency is going to be the piece where you're going to have people that go, yeah, I never get that. I've never had right. all experience, right?
And that's the challenge. And that's the challenge with like true situational empathy is in, and so the, you know, how you solve for that, it's almost like a, ironically, like a Southwest example, which is you just hire better, different people, right?
Yeah.
You hire people who are tuned for empathy. So often in business, we want to keep it consistent. So we have to script it. We need software. We need policies. We need procedures. We need an SOP for empathy. But really, the empathy that stands out is the empathy that is on the fly. And that requires a different kind of team member, not a script.
A famous African proverb says that if you want to go fast, go alone. But if you want to go far, go together. At Nobel Biz, we have made it our mission to travel far and wide with our partners and clients. As a complete telecom services provider with over 20 years of experience in the industry, Nobel Biz offers the only voice carrier network designed with the sole purpose of serving call centers around the world. This contact center dedicated carrier network provides crystal clear voice traffic, up-to-date compliance tools, intelligent routing, and highly secure data protocols combined with 99.9% uptime and easy setup. Our goal for 2022 is to become the ultimate partner and provider for the contact center industry by placing service quality at the top of our priority list. To top it off, at Nobel Biz, we have the most competitive cost per minute model in the industry. Need proof? Reach out to us and learn more about the Nobel Biz Voice Carrier Network at www.nobelbiz.com.
Yeah, I completely agree with that. And I was going to say that, you know, when you have that one superstar, it's awesome. And it does everything you just said. But when the brand doesn't find a way to say, that is different, that is awesome, let's find a way to replicate that genuinely, then what ends up happening is you have these moments, these flash in the pan, and then you have the bigger business that just has its normal operation, and you don't get to have that continue. You know, it's like your favorite restaurant. The one time they really screw up, you're like, I'm going to give them one more chance. But after that, it's like they're not my favorite restaurant anymore. They're not consistently giving me that experience.
Yep. It's one of the things that I talked about in my word of mouth book, because when I wrote that book, the kind of big cause celeb in marketing was kind of surprise and delight campaigns, right? Where you know, you're in, going to a Marriott, right? And you check in and, you know, in your room, there's a live elephant or whatever. You're like, oh my God, they know that I love elephants. And they put one in my room and like, you know, put it in social media and they get downstream awareness. That was like a big tactic for a lot of, especially B2C brands at that time. And in the book, I was like, this is dumb because, you know, you're going to get a little shot of word of mouth, but then it's going to fade away. And the bigger issue is every other customer is like, hey, man, where's my elephant, right? You're literally like setting an expectation that you can't, that you can't sustain. And look, customer experience doesn't actually exist. Like, we kind of, it's fake. Like, we made it up. It's just a nickname.
Yeah.
Customer experience is the difference between what people expect and what actually occurs. That's all it is. It's the difference between what they think is going to happen and what actually happened. And that works both ways, right? Yes, customer expectations continue to escalate, which is hard for business. But in some cases, businesses keep giving customers a reason to expect more in circumstances like this. Oh, there's an elephant in this guy's hotel room. And so at some level, you're sort of slitting your own throat. And this is kind of going back to something you said earlier. For me, one of the scariest things about AI for business is that customers are going to expect everything to be instant and everything to be hyper-personalized. And it's going to be really, really hard for all businesses to execute on that.
Well, let's kind of talk about that, because I really want to dive deeper into this concept of AI and people fearing, you know, losing their jobs, people saying that, you know, it's going to now be the most, you know, personalized individual experience. But when you look at it today, there's also a lot of people that are using it as a shiny object. And it's just the next thing to put in play. And they're implementing it in a really crappy way. It's a really crappy experience where people are sitting there going, let me talk to a human. This sucks. And now when you talk to a human, it's not a normal conversation. It's an elevated emotional conversation because you pissed me off. And now I have to make sure that representative agent can handle someone that's sitting there going, you guys suck. And I now have to be really emotional in this conversation. So AI tech, I think it's great when it's used properly and you understand how to measure if it's actually doing what you want and you have an outcome, something that you know what it's going to be for you. And if not, then otherwise it's the next shiny object. I mean, are you seeing that same thing and how people are missing the mark versus people are going like, okay, this is how you actually implement this?
Yeah. I mean, right now I think everybody is just sort of in the, give me some of that AI. Right. They don't even know
what it is,
what they're just, I just, you know, I, my boss says I have to have AI. So let me get AI. We're in that sort of part of the hype cycle, which is natural. The better way to do it is to say, okay, what are all of our processes and key decision points and inflection points, drop off points, friction points, like, and how can we use AI to improve those specific things? Right. So you should be thinking about it through tasks, assignments, goals, objectives, math, not I just want AI, because just like customer experience, even say AI doesn't make any sense, right? There's like, we're very close to a situation where to say I need AI is like saying I need computer, right? Like, because AI is going to be in everything. So to say I need AI is almost like a ridiculous statement, because everything will have AI. So, you know, it's like having a department of radio, like, just, it's dumb, right? So, but I will say the other problem right now is that most business leaders are looking at AI as a way to increase margin, right? They're looking at AI as efficiency gains, as opposed to what I think they should be doing, which is using AI as a way to delight their customers more. Both are possible. They don't have to be, in opposition, but I think right now they're largely in opposition, right? You can either use AI to do the same amount of stuff that you're doing today cheaper, or you can use AI to spend the same amount you're spending now, but do more. And I think the latter is the better approach personally, again, because I believe in lifetime value probably more than most people. But I've seen some pretty exciting demos around empathic AI and voice and stuff like that. Like, there's some pretty crazy stuff coming, which I'm really, really excited about. But as always, right, the devil's in the details. I think everybody's a little like, yeah, I was promised a better chatbot too, and that didn't work out, right? And so, you know, now you're like, oh, and now's chatbot 2.0. Like, I'm not that stoked. I think AI is a lot more than that, but there, in my estimation, there's a fair amount of skepticism, certainly amongst consumers, about kind of what AI customer experience is going to mean for them.
Yeah, I mean, you know, omnichannel has been discussed for a really long time, right? And the ideal of having this truly centralized way of just knowing how to engage, when to engage, and what medium to engage, be able to shift from one medium to another flawlessly, and be able to not have to repeat who you are, why you're wanting to reach out. I don't have access to X or Y, and I don't have the ability to do A or B. You know, that's been talked about forever, and it's still not something that many brands can do well. And so now you add on top of that AI, where you're saying there's the part where you can just reduce costs, right? And then the empathy piece starts to go out the window, because it becomes extremely transactional right now if you don't do a good job. It's A or B, and there isn't this ability to have that human connection, right? That piece that allows you to say, yeah, it's great. You may have gotten speed down. Yeah, I got it really fast. But to your book, right, is there a time when fast is too fast and it actually not something you want to do?
All the time. And let me just touch on something you said a second ago. The big mistake that folks are making in terms of AI and CX, first of all, looking at it solely as a way to cut costs is first. But the other one, sort of a bigger question, is it doesn't matter how much AI tech you buy if you don't have all your data dialed in perfectly. Because AI requires access to all your data to do omnichannel, to do anything, to do predictive outreach, to do anything magical that we want AI to do with regards to customer experience, customer service, requires exceptional data alignment inside organizations. And people are looking at this in the wrong sequence. They're like, okay, let me buy AI. Oh, crap. Now we got to get our data figured out. Like, you're doing it in the wrong order. Like, you need to be doing a serious data cleanliness and alignment project now, get that figured out, and then determine what AI can do with this new data. So there's some sequencing issues in a lot of companies right now.
Yeah.
Well, but yes, go ahead.
No, go ahead. No. You're getting to the second part.
I was just going to say that. Yeah. So you can definitely be too fast. Like the reality is, and I wrote about this, you know, a lot in the book, you probably should be faster than you are much of the time. That is true. And customers will reward you accordingly. But you can be too fast. And what happens is, when you are too fast, it actually decays trust. So, for example, when I went to a Mexican food restaurant here in Indiana, not home of authentic Latino cuisine, Indiana typically, but I'm from Arizona. So you can take the boy out of Arizona, but you can't take the Arizona out of the boy. So I go to this Mexican restaurant, I order enchiladas, and they bring me chicken enchiladas in 90 seconds. Like, it was astonishing. I was like, how did they possibly make these enchiladas that quickly? Like, do they just have a machine that I don't know about? Did somebody order like beef enchiladas and they're like, oh, no, that's the wrong one? And they put it on the hot window and waited for somebody else to order it. Do they have a psychic? Like, I was very confusing. And it was so fast that I distrusted the enchiladas. I was like, this is sketch. I ate them anyway, because again, beggars can't be choosers in Indiana, but I was skeptical and concerned. And they were just okay, to be truthful. And so when you're, you know, you don't want to be like, hey, I think I need to have my spleen removed. And they're like, okay, what are you doing in the next 5 minutes? Right? Like, that's too fast. Like, you shouldn't be that available. Right? Like, I'm thinking about getting divorced. Cool. What are you doing tonight? Like, there's circumstances when it's too fast and you're like, why is this so quick? And when you do that, people realize, like, wait a second, quality can't be high if it's that fast. And so what you want in every customer interaction, the place you want to be, we call it the right now. And the right now is just slightly faster than customers expect. My buddy Don is a pilot for American, and he's a genius at this. So it's this whole idea of expectation management, man. So he gets in his headset, like, air traffic control is like, oh yeah, there's a plane behind you. You can't back up. They're blocking the exit. So it's going to be a 12-minute delay. So he gets on the speakers. Hey, it's Captain Mendler. Welcome to American Airlines 731, San Diego to Phoenix. Unfortunately, there's a plane behind us. We can't exit the gate just yet. It's going to be a 15-minute delay. So sorry. I'll let you know when we're getting ready to depart. So then he's just sitting there. And then ATC gets back on. and says, okay, you're ready to go. And it's been 13 minutes. So he gets on. He's like, hey, it's Captain Mendler. Great news. We're ready to go. It's only been 13 minutes, right? So he literally fibs to the customer every time because he like makes the expectation here and then he knows he can beat it, right? And that is the greatest way to run a business. Like, look, we've been talking about this for 5,000 years. Like, I don't even know, like a long time. Everybody knows this, that you should always under promise and over deliver. Like everybody knows this, but yet so often we try and do the opposite and it doesn't work. So it works the exact same way with speed. Like I'm not saying, you know, build in 6 months worth of padding, but you're better off giving them a little bigger estimate that you know you can beat.
Yeah, I think it's important, that piece of setting proper expectations and managing them, because nothing is perfect. Stuff happens. And that communication, that ability to manage through that allows, like earlier, we talked about that anxiety not only to go down, but the trust starts to go up. And then there's also that perception of value where someone, yeah, true, someday someone may create a better mousetrap, and that better mousetrap does get the things a lot faster and it is still of high quality. And if you create that, great, then you can market that and hopefully you can sell it and it becomes adopted. But until that happens, there are going to be certain things that you're going to say vendor A can do it in half the speed. But if you know that the outcome that you deliver is that much better, then there's still going to be that piece where you're going to have to manage between. Maybe it is, you're right. Maybe you get the spleen doctor that goes like, yeah, you know, this isn't something you're going to do in 10 minutes. This is really the journey you're going to take. And this is how long it takes. This is what recovery looks like. And you're like, yeah, I feel a lot better with you taking it out versus the other one, the other person doing that. So I can totally see that happening. So I want to
know, is if you're going to be the longer one, right? If you're going to be the bespoke, you know, we're going to make this by hand, whatever, you can absolutely still win with that model. You just have to be really good at communicating why you take so much longer than the alternative. And as long as you can be really good at the comms around that, you can absolutely succeed. But you can't succeed, be like, oh, they do it in 2 days, we do it in 2 weeks. How come? Because that's just how we do. Like, that's not going to work. Like, there's got to be a rationale for that, that the customer can understand and assign value to. You just being slower than your competition is not a situation you're going to be able to survive much longer.
Yeah. And it also has to be something that you really set up front, right? Can't be that they get it from you. And it's like, yeah, after the fact,
by the way,
you bought this, this is going to take X amount of time, right?
Yeah.
A lot of that during the pandemic, right? A lot of parts, availability of things, people couldn't get stuff. So communication was huge. So with time, I know we could talk forever, but I really want to shift to another topic because it's really fascinating. Okay. Even in our pre-discussion, we were talking about this, but the concept of, you're doing all these businesses, you have all this experience and customer experience journey, growth, and then now you have tequila. Where did that come in? Has that always been there? It just became a part of your life where now it's more fun versus back in. Like, you got to talk about how that even happened in the first place.
Yeah, you can find me at Tequila J Bear on Instagram, TikTok, YouTube. I am in one of the most popular tequila content creators in the world now. I've always been interested in agave spirits growing up in Arizona, going to school in Tucson by the border, and just over time learned more and more about it and started visiting distilleries in Mexico, et cetera. About 2 years ago, I sold my consulting firm. And so I freed up some time and I thought, you know, I wonder what would happen if I just made some videos about some of the things I've learned about tequila. And that was the end of strategy. That was literally a one sentence strategy. This would be fun. And my whole goal, my only goal, Christian, was to somehow make at least like $5 so that I could tell my accountant that all my tequila purchases could be a business expense, not a personal. So that was like, that was literally the plan. Like, okay, let's make videos and it'll be I can use my Amex instead of my Visa to buy tequila. That was the assignment. And it kind of went crazy. And now we've got, you know, hundreds of thousands of followers combined across the platforms. And we make, you know, 20 videos a month. And we have lots and lots of sponsorships and we've got merchandise and affiliate programs. And it's a real business. It's 300% growth last year to this year. So it's a lot of fun, but now it's like a real job, right? Now it's like, you know, that's what happens when your passion becomes an actual job. You're like, oh, now I got to like really do this. But it's a blast. We love that community. The Agave Spirits community, both the producer side and the fan side is just really magical. So it's an absolute honor, to do it. It's a lot of fun, but it's weird for me having been a B2B content creator forever, right? Podcasts, books, speaking, blogs, you know, all that stuff, to now be a B2C content creator. It's a different set of mechanics for sure.
So with that being said, you know, you have all this experience, all this background, B2B. Is there anything that you've been able to take from that, that you pulled over to tequila that didn't work the way you expected? Or did everything just match and you said, man, this is awesome? And you went from, I'm going to be able to write off some tequila to like, this is one of the top people in the space.
I mean, part of it's the same. I wrote a book called Utility many years ago. And the thesis of that book is that helping beats selling. And that's really what I've always tried to do. And certainly what we try to do at Tequila J. Bear is just answer the questions that people have and don't make them feel stupid and just be helpful. Like, you know, that's why I spend an hour a night just answering DMs. Like, no question is too small, right? Just if you help everybody, eventually you will succeed. I really believe that. And I've proven it over and over. So that's one of the things that kind of applies across the board. But one thing I did learn is that B2C consumers, especially when it's algorithm driven, right? So Instagram, TikTok, whatever, is going to show your content to whoever they think is appropriate. And especially in the tequila world, none of those people have any idea who I am, what my background is, whatever. And they don't care, right? And so the level of sort of respect and deference in B2B content is one thing. B2C content, they don't care, right? The number of, why should I listen to you about tequila, white boy, type of comment. Like, there's a lot of like true negativity sometimes. Like, ooh, that stings. Like, ooh, ouch. There's definitely some, I wrote a book called Hug Your Haters, which is all about how to deal with difficult customers. And I've had to reread that book for my own tequila accounts, because I'm like, wow, you start talking about consumers. They do not hold back. You know, B2B folks keep it pretty civil. B2C, not so much. So that's been interesting.
Well, that raw feedback also probably has to give you not only a thicker skin, but also allows you to embrace some of that stuff. Like, I think
it's almost always right.
Yeah, you know, it's some interesting level. To look in the mirror almost, but it's from a different perspective. So I want to finish off with one piece, because I know we're running out of time. Is you've gone back through your career, and you just sat back and said, okay, if there's one piece of advice that I would have offered my younger self, what would that have been when you look back and you see all the things you've done?
It's actually advice that I really try to follow. And I actually have a sign that says this just off camera over here. And it says, remember, some days you're the pigeon and some days you're the statue. And I really love that advice, because it doesn't matter who you are, what you are, where you are, what you're doing. There's going to be days that go great and there are going to be days that go terribly. And neither of those are truth. You really have to understand that there's going to be natural ups and downs in any career, any assignment, any project. And I really try to keep a pretty even keel. Like, yeah, I get excited about wins and I get disappointed by losses, but I really try to say, like, let's just look at this over the long term. And as long as you're making incremental progress, you're in great shape. So I just try to not get too emotional about this kind of stuff. It helps that I'm Swiss and it helps that I'm a Libra. Like, all of that is probably good ingredients for this mindset. But I find that especially newer entrepreneurs tend to get a little too up and down, and it doesn't actually help them. It actually hurts them. So that's my advice, is just try and keep an even keel and not get too excited and not get too disappointed.
Great advice. Now, look, I know there's going to be people that want to get a hold of you. They want to contact you, follow you. How best do they do that?
For all business things, it's jbear.com, B-A-E-R. You can find all the books on Amazon and also on the J Bear website, tequilajbear.com for all things tequila. You can also find it, of course, on Instagram, TikTok, and YouTube. And breaking news, you're literally the first person I've ever told this to. in a show. I am starting a new podcast, and it'll be ready to roll probably a week or so after this episode drops. It's called The Spirit Guides. And it's me interviewing other people who are content creators around tequila, rum, vodka, gin, scotch, whiskey, bourbon, et cetera. And it's all the origin stories. So, you know, why, how did this happen for me? There's a lot of other people who used to be a realtor or used to be a whatever and are now making content about spirits. So that's going to be the new show, The Spirit Guides. Look for it. Coming soon.
Oh, I'm definitely going to. That's going to be awesome.
Thanks.
So excited for you to have you on. We could talk forever. And trust me, there's going to have to be an episode on tequila because it's just
such
an interesting spirit. And so many people have either a really horrible experience with it, or there's people that are in that group of saying, wow, we're part of that 300% growth that's happening for sure. So look, that wraps another episode. First Contact Stories of the Call Center. Huge thank you to Jay for joining us today. And look out for our future episodes. Thanks for joining us. Thanks for all of you who listen and our great audience. We appreciate it. We'll talk soon.
Thank you for joining me in this episode. If you're loving the content, make sure to hit that subscribe button on your YouTube channel for exclusive clips, webinars, workshops, and bonus materials. And if you're an Apple iTunes listener, we greatly appreciate a 5-star rating and review to help spread the word. On our YouTube page, you can also leave us feedback, comments, and suggest future guests that you'd like to hear from. For even more valuable insights and information on the call center world, visit nobelbiz.com and access our on-demand webinars. I'm Christian Montez, and thank you for tuning in to another episode of First Contact Podcast. Stay with us for the next exciting chapter.